Let's turn in our Bibles to the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 25. Be reading beginning in verse 19 all the way to the end of the chapter again. We're going to do this week what we've done a few other times, which is allow for some questions and answers. And hopefully I'll remember to take a couple breaks and ask you if you have some. One of the reasons I want to do that this week is because this is a point of transition of the generations of Isaac. It's a new step in the story of redemption as it's laid out in the book of Genesis. It's interesting, I think, at least I find it interesting, that these are the generations of Isaac and we hear almost nothing of Isaac in this book, in this section. It's mostly about Jacob. It's interesting as well to see the foibles and the failings of both of these men. Isaac does not come across very favorably in the book of Genesis. The things that are favorable about him are things that God does to him. His response is usually weak. Jacob, maybe even more so, comes across badly in the book of Genesis, at least at the beginning of the story. I wanted to set up maybe with a little story. We have at least one Jacob here, right? Jake, is that short for Jacob? All right, we have one Jacob. Ann and I, every time we had a boy, struggled through names. And Jacob is one of my favorite names. And Ann, not so much. Every time we talk about it, she said, I don't want to name my son a name that means deceiver, heel grabber, which I think is, it seems, just a picture of what it means to deceive. She said, I don't want that to be the name of my son. And I always told her the reason that I liked Jacob was for the very fact that that's what his name meant, and to see his place in the story of redemption, despite the fact that he is deceitful and conniving. And I say that because I can relate to Jacob. It's a lot harder to relate to Abraham, I think, because he has the kind of faith that I wish that I had. And yet I always seem to miss that mark. You might remember when we were working through Abraham and when he is willing to sacrifice Isaac on the mountain. I mentioned that Kierkegaard, in writing about that passage, says, I can't even understand Abraham and how he could do that. I can't even relate to the fact that he's willing to obey God in that situation. And that's a lot of times how I feel about Abraham. I can't relate to him because my faith is so much weaker than his. Now, Jacob, I can relate to. This is a man who's always trying to get his way, and always, even when he's striving after the promises of God, he's trying to get them in his timing and in his way, and he's not willing to wait for God to do it. That's something I can relate to. And the fact that despite all those things, God loves him, and that God chooses Jacob over Esau, not because he's all that much better than Esau, although he's maybe a little bit better. He chooses him because he loves him. I warned you this morning, we're going to talk about election again like we did this morning. But that's what's so beautiful about the story of Jacob, that he's not chosen because of anything in him. He's chosen because God loves him and God's gracious. And how much more is that true of me and of you? That God doesn't choose us because of what we bring. He chooses us because he loves us. That's one of the things that we can learn from the life of Jacob. All right, let's read Genesis 25, verses 19 to the end of the chapter. And let's remember, as these words are being read, that this is God's perfect word. These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to be his wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife, because she was barren. And the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is thus, why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the older, or the other. The older shall serve the younger. When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak. So they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore, his name was called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I am about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" So he swore to him and sold. Oh, sorry, I skipped the verse. Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. I talked a little bit about Jacob and his frailties, but it's not just Jacob, right? I mean, the rest of Genesis is filled with dysfunctional families. I think there's something instructive in that for us. There's dysfunction in the rest of Genesis that makes the maneuverings of Abraham and Sarah appear tame. And like I said before, at some level, that makes Jacob and even Isaac and Rebekah more accessible to us, I think. We can understand their frailties and we can appreciate and we can rejoice in God's grace as he shows it to him. The character in the history of Jacob is one that it begins at least with unbelief, stubbornness, slow progress, struggling with God, but a slow and steady transformation to a man of faith. Even at the end of Genesis, he's still failing, but he becomes humble and he realizes his dependence on God after many hardships and trials. I can understand that. Can you? And also, despite his regular rebellion, the Lord never releases Jacob from his hand. The grip of God's grace is so powerful that no matter what Jacob does, God will not let go of him. That I can not only understand, that's something I need. I need to understand the relentless grip of God's grace. As well, we need to know that God's promises and his divine purpose stand even when we fail. And isn't that what we learn from Jacob and Isaac and Rebekah? That despite family fighting and scheming and disunity and struggle within the household of God, his divine purpose never fails. That though the chosen people of God are often unfaithful, God always remains faithful to his elect. That I need. I need to know that's true. In fact, that's what the Israelites needed to know. Remember, Moses is writing to the Israelites as they're preparing to go into the promised land. And he's reminding them that he is faithful and that they're not necessarily faithful. But that God is always faithful, that God always protects his people. And in fact, in Jacob, we see someone who is not worthy to be the seed of the woman. Can we admit that? As we look at Jacob again and again, can we admit that he's not worthy, at least in the eyes of the world, to be the seed of the woman? But God chooses Jacob. And it's an act that is totally of God's grace. That's the pattern that we're going to see in these chapters. Isaac is weak and vacillating. We're going to see it already today. Isaac knows, but we can be sure that Rebekah told Isaac what God told her. I'm choosing the younger. Isaac knows that. And who does he choose? He chooses the older. And he tries again and again to give the blessing to Esau, despite what God told him. And Jacob, He knows, I'm sure that Rebecca told him, he knows that he's the chosen one. And yet he doesn't wait for God to make that clear. He schemes and he connives and does whatever he can to get the upper hand. He never waits for God, or at least at the beginning. He refuses to wait for God to simply do what he promised to do. And God, in the midst of all of this, is faithful and gracious, true to his word, the same yesterday, today and forever, despite the wickedness and the failings of his people. Now, we get a good picture of Isaac at the beginning of this section. And we need to see that. This is a favorable picture of Isaac beginning in verse 19. In fact, there's in some ways, I think, supposed to be a comparison going on between Isaac and Abraham. We see things happening in his life that are the same things that happened to Abraham. In particular, his wife is barren. That was the struggle for years for Abraham and Sarah. This is, of course, always difficult, a wife that's barren, but it's especially difficult for the child of promise. God has promised Abraham, and therefore God has promised Isaac, that they will have children as many as the stars of the heaven and the sand of the desert. And here's Isaac, 40 and all the way to 60 years old, without any children. In the midst of that, we see the faith of Isaac. He apparently avoids the scheming of Abraham, or at least we're not told of any kind of scheming to bring about God's promises more quickly than the Lord would choose to do it. This is, by the way, the only patriarch of the three who has one wife. The only patriarch who never flees the promised land, even when he's being chased and even when the nations are threatening him. There are things to admire about Isaac, things about him that show the kind of faithfulness that isn't evident in the life of Abraham and certainly not evident in the life of Jacob. And as he faces his wife being barren, what's his response? He prays. He knows that God is the one who closes and God is the one who opens wombs. And so he prays. And he apparently prays with power, because we're told in verse 21 that Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his prayer and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. What we're not told in verse 21 is that he prayed for 20 years. I mean, isn't the implication of verse 21, doesn't it look like Isaac prayed and God answered right away? It's not until the end of this section that we're told that the same man who was married at the age of 40, his sons are born when he's 60. We're supposed to understand Isaac to be one who perseveres by faith, continually seeking the face of God, knowing that because God promised to give him children, God would do that very thing, even if it meant waiting for an uncomfortably long time. There's the faith of Isaac. Rebekah conceives. And we're told in verse 22 that after she conceives, there's a struggle going on within her. The children struggle together within her. The word has to do with crushing. It's not just a little bit of a struggle or a little bit of pain or uncomfortableness. There's a struggle going on that almost feels as if these two children are going to destroy each other. That's the picture that we're given. And that's the reason that she's afraid. This isn't normal. There's a battle going on within her womb. And so she cries out to God, just like Isaac did. There's children are struggling within her, trying to crush each other. And she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger." How's that for comforting words for a mother? It's not just two children wrestling for space in your body. These are two nations that are at war with each other even now, before they're outside your womb, and they will continue to fight with each other, not just for their lives, but for the lives of their children and their grandchildren. This is the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent inside Rebekah. A war that continues to rage today. And God tells her that not only are there two nations within her, but that he's in control of it, essentially. That there are two nations within you, and that one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger. And as we know later, this is because God declares it to be so. God's grace triumphs in the situation, and he works in a way that's different than the world would expect. He chooses the younger over and against the older. Do you understand the power of what's being said? If we can forget for a moment the turmoil that this would cause for Rebekah and Isaac. Understand the power of the message that God's grace triumphs over human convention. He's not bound by the things of the world. A world that would say that the older is chosen over the younger and that the younger would serve the older. He's not bound by those conventions. He chooses the younger and he does it again and again and again. He did it in the life of Isaac. He does it in the life of Jacob. He does it in the children of Jacob. He does it in the life of David. We see this pattern again and again. The Lord chooses those who, in the eyes of the world, are in a position of lesser authority. And he makes them the ones through whom the promises will come. This teaches us, of course, about God's sovereign choice, his electing power, that he chooses whom he will choose because he decides who will receive mercy and who will not. We can't get away from it, even in the Old Testament. I've told some of you before that Joel Bascom, who loves to study the Old Testament, he said that when he became convinced of election, it wasn't reading the New Testament, it was reading the Old Testament. We see it in Genesis again and again. God chooses whom he chooses because he's God. Do you remember how Paul in Romans 9 explains what happens with Jacob and Esau? Romans 9, verses 10 through 13. We looked at it this morning. We need to look at it again. Paul says in Romans 9, verse 10, "Not only so, but also when Rebekah had conceived children by one man, our father Isaac, though they were not yet born and had done nothing, either good or bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of his call, she was told the older will serve the younger. As it is written, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated." You see what Paul's doing. He's pointing out the things that couldn't be the determining factor in God choosing. They're born from the same parents. That wasn't true of Isaac, right? Isaac and Ishmael. Ishmael was born of Abraham and Hagar. Isaac was born of Abraham and Sarah. So you could at least say the reason God chose Isaac was because he was born of the right mother. You can't say that of Jacob and Esau. They have the same father and the same mother. And not only that, God chose them before they were born, before they did anything, either good or bad. He didn't choose them because of their works or because of their worth. He chose Jacob simply because he chose Jacob. And he did it to display his grace and his mercy and his justice. And if that's unclear, it's proven to us again and again as we see Jacob and Esau next to each other. Neither of them come off very well, do they? God didn't choose Jacob because he was some faithful, obedient servant of the Lord. He chose him because he chose him. Right away, we see differences between Jacob and Esau. In verse 25, we're told of Esau, the first one that comes out, that he's red, his body is like a hairy cloak, so they called his name Esau. His appearance is supposed to be a little bit threatening. We had a little laugh over this at the Wellover's house earlier, but in the Old Testament, people with red hair don't usually come off very well. They're threatening and scary in ancient culture. And people with hair all over their bodies, it's usually not a good sign in the Old Testament or in any ancient culture. Right away, he comes across as threatening and a little bit strange. Jacob, of course, doesn't come across that well either. After, we're told in verse 26 that after Esau is born, he comes out with a hand on his heel, grabbing him. And essentially, I think the picture we're supposed to have is he's trying to pull Esau back in so that he can get out first. He's already trying to gain that birthright even before he's old enough to make any stew. But even worse than the fact that they're different, Esau being a skillful hunter, a man of the field, Jacob being a quiet man dwelling in tents, even more ominous is how their parents respond to them. Verse 28, it says, "Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob." parental favoritism. Never a good thing. Never a way to a peaceful house. It's interesting, by the way, how this same sin is bears fruit in the life of Jacob, who chooses one of his sons over all the rest and leads to all sorts of turmoil in his house. Who chooses one wife over his other wives. That's a different story to deal with later. And how this kind of favoritism leads to all sorts of hostility and struggle within the household of God. But especially ominous in verse 28 is the reason that Isaac loved Esau better than Jacob. Because he ate of his game. Paul in Philippians and the book of Jude were told of those who are whose gods, their God is their belly. This is how Isaac comes across in his dealings with his children. Again, he probably knows that God has already prophesied that he's choosing Jacob over Esau. But Isaac is so controlled by his belly and by eating and by food that he loves Esau more than Jacob because he provides venison for him. Whereas Rebekah loves Jacob. Before we move on, are there any questions about what's happening here? Yes, Joy. Right. Yeah, I mean, you don't see well-managed households, at least here. You don't see it in Isaac or Jacob. You don't see it in Judah. Yeah, I mean, no, it's a real problem. I mean, I think even though I think ultimately Genesis is about redemption, there are certainly things that we can learn about how to live as the people of God, and both in a positive way and in a negative way, things to avoid. Any other? David.
So, when you mentioned that the heirs of Esau and Jacob continue to fight each other to this day, and are you meaning to this day?
I mean to this day in the sense that there's still a seed of the serpent and a seed of the woman at war with each other. I'm not applying it to nations because I think that changes in the New Testament. But there's still a church and the world. Or to use Augustine's terms, the city of God and the city of man, and they're at war with each other. And I think that's, you know, simply these same things in Genesis being born out in the history of the world. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, Jared. Yeah, they didn't have the scriptures. The beginning of Hebrews talks about all the ways, all the previous ways that God spoke to his people through prophets and through apostles. But now he's spoken to us through his son. And so those things, we don't need them anymore. We have the scriptures. And God speaks to us by the power of his Holy Spirit that dwells within us and that applies the word to us. And so things are different now. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Speaks to Hannah too, through Eli, I guess. But I mean, yeah, that's definitely true. Anything else? All right. Yeah. Yep. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, something like that. And she was too, so they weren't having children. Was she? Oh, I forgot about that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything else? I just looked at the time. We got to fly here. So the rest of the story is familiar. So I want to look at things, you know, big picture kind of things that we can see. the story that we have that closes out this chapter, it looks backward and forward at the same time, I think. First of all, it looks backward because we see that oracle that was given to Rebekah start to be fulfilled in the way that God providentially works in this situation. But it also looks forward because I think we see the character of Jacob and Esau starting to be revealed to us. We see things about Jacob, and mostly not good things, that are part of his character that follow him throughout the rest of Genesis. We also see two nations at war with each other. One fights dirty. That's Jacob. And the other fights for the wrong things. He fights for temporal blessings rather than the eternal blessings that are available through the promises to Abraham. Now, first of all, we see the character of Jacob. Notice that when his brother comes and he's hungry, he doesn't respond in the way that Abraham responded to visitors coming to him. He doesn't respond in the way that Rebekah responded to Abraham's servant that came to her. They were characterized by hospitality. Jacob, instead of loving his brother and giving him something to eat because he's hungry, he sees an opportunity. He's willing to give him some of this stew, but only if he gets what he wants first. And he's willing to make Esau suffer if that's what's necessary to get what he wants. Esau returns very hungry from hunting. He begs fervently for something to eat. We see something of the character of Esau and even how he asks for this stew and what he says. It doesn't come across in English because it would be almost nonsensical in English. But basically what he says is, give me some of that red stuff. It's not stew, it's just red. It's the word for red, basically. But he basically says, red stuff, red stuff. He's so hungry that he's not even piecing together sentences. Just give me some of this red stuff. We see something of his lack of manners and civility, even in the way he asks for it. He doesn't say, I'm hungry, would you please give me some of that stew that you've been working hard on? He just simply demands red stuff. And every time you see red stew, that's really what it says, red stuff. You get a sense as well of how he's controlled, like his father, by his stomach. It's more important for him to get something to eat than it is to be a recipient of the promises of God. And Jacob knows his brother well enough to know that there's an opportunity for him here. He certainly knows about the oracle. Rebekah must have told him, you're the chosen one, the promise is for you. And that becomes evident in chapter 27. But he sees an opportunity to seize the blessing and to seize the birthright now. He's not willing to wait for what God's going to do and how he's going to bring it about. Now, there's kind of a mixture that goes on in Jacob. I think this is why we can relate to him. He's not all bad and he's not all good. So there's something positive about the way he responds. The thing that we see in Jacob that we don't see in Esau is he understands the importance of the blessing of God and the promises of the birthright, and he wants it. Esau could care less. Birthright, who cares? I just want to eat. So Jacob at least has the vision of the covenant. He knows that this is more important than food and this is what he wants. But he takes matters into his own hands. And he uses Esau's hunger against him. And he convinces him to sell the birthright to him now. We see the character of Esau as well. This is somebody who is nearsighted. He valued stew, or as I said, red stuff, more than he valued the covenant and the inheritance that belongs to the people of God. This is exactly what the writer of Hebrews tells us. In Hebrews 12, verses 16 and 17, he uses Esau as a negative example. He warns us that against sin, and he says that no one is sexually immoral or unholy, or another word would be profane, like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, though he sought it. In other words, he sought the birthright with tears. This is how the writer of Hebrews describes being unholy or profane. It's someone who's driven by temporal appetites, driven by the passions of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, and is willing to settle for those present but temporary blessings, not able to look ahead for what was described as Abraham looking ahead for a better city or better promises. Esau can't see that far. He can only see what's right in front of his face. This answers, by the way, in part, the argument about fairness and election. How is it just for God to choose some and not to choose others? And the answer is simply, if you see in the life of Esau, God didn't do anything unfair. He gave him exactly what he wanted. He wasn't looking for the birthright. He didn't want the blessing. He wanted food, and he got it. I mentioned the example of Noah this morning. It wasn't like he was fighting off the other people at the door. No, you can't get into the ark. I don't care if you want it. They could care less. They just wanted the things that they could have right now. And that's exactly what we see in Esau. He got exactly what he wanted. And it's interesting how the chapter ends. Verse 34, it says, "Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way." There's a reason that we're given this really quick description. The idea in your head should be Esau sits down and he shovels all this stuff into his mouth and he walks away as if nothing happened. He doesn't care. He doesn't think for a moment about the fact that he just gave up the covenant promises of God. He just knows that he's full and that he's satisfied. No regrets. He doesn't have the ability to understand or acknowledge that he lost something more valuable than a bowl of soup. And so the chapter ends by telling us that Esau despised his birthright. By his actions, he proved that he didn't care about them, that he despised them, that he held them in contempt. He treated them as if they were worthless. So Esau comes off very badly in this story. But what about Jacob? He comes across as mixed, doesn't he? He has a vision for the blessings, but he doesn't have the faith to wait for God to bring them about. He comes across in the same convoluted, twisted, conflicted way that we'll see throughout the rest of Genesis. Somehow God gives him faith so that he's able to see that the blessing and the birthright is something that he should want and desire. But he's still a deceitful schemer, clinging to the heels of his brother, trying to pull him back into his mother's womb. Unwilling to wait for the promises. And that's what makes Jacob both infuriating and comforting. Isn't it? Can you see yourself there? I know what I want. I know I want the blessings of God, but I'm not always content to receive them in the way that God intended them to be received. I wanted to close really with these words. They're from Gerhardus Voss. He wrote a book called Biblical Theology, and he has this to say about Jacob and what Jacob's story teaches us about the grace of God. He says that Jacob's reprehensible features are strongly brought out. They're there for us to see, right? Not bashful about showing us Jacob's sin. And he says this is done in order to show that the divine grace is not the reward for, but the source of noble traits. In other words, Jacob doesn't receive the grace of God because he earned it. He receives it because God loved him. And then any kind of good character that we see in Jacob as he progresses by faith is a result of the grace, not a cause for the grace of God. He closes by saying this. He says, "Grace overcoming human sin and transforming human nature is the keynote of the revelation here." Grace overturning sin. Grace transforming human nature. Is that a message we need? In our sin and our struggle against sin and our struggles against the passions that are within us, the old nature constantly rising up and trying to overtake us and us trying to beat it down and failing again and again. We need to be reminded that God is gracious and that even though we fail, and even when we're not faithful, he's faithful. And I can't think of a better image of that than the image of Jacob. Fighting and kicking and wrestling with God. And yet God always prevails. And God always covers him with his grace and with his blessing. Any questions or comments before we close up? Yeah, Dick.
Jacob, I love less.
We struggle with election, don't we? Makes us uncomfortable sometimes. But I think, and we talked about this more this morning in kind of a different context, but I think it's one of the most comforting things that we can know. I mean, the reason that I'm excited about getting into Jacob is because I need to be reminded that God's grace is greater than my sin. We sing that in one of the hymns. We sang it last week in the morning service. His grace is greater than my sin. I need to know that over and over again, because if I look at myself, it seems hopeless. But if I look at God and if I look at Jesus Christ, that's the power of the gospel. Yeah, William. I don't know. I think Jacob does a lot of the cooking. He's kind of the... Yeah, I don't know. I think Jacob does a lot of the cooking with his mom. So I think if he was going to eat, he was going to come there. But, yeah. Man, we could be here for an hour about that one. Yeah, I think you have to let the context kind of determine what it means by love and hate. And in that context, I think it's the same kind of thing where Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. He clearly has a love for Jerusalem, and he doesn't desire to see the wicked perish. I mean, Ezekiel talks about that, even though other prophet talks about God hating Esau. I mean, there's degrees of love, and God has compassion, and Jesus has compassion on sinners. But it's not necessarily an effectual love that brings about their salvation. I mean, that's a whole big thing we could wrestle with for hours. But I do think we have to kind of allow the context to tell us what it means. And so Esau, I hated. The reason that people struggle with that is because we think of hate like how we hate. And we're trying to apply the kind of emotions that I have to a God who doesn't have emotions and he doesn't have passions. I mean, that's how his character is described. And so, I don't know, there's a lot of intricacies in there. But I think that, yeah, the rich young ruler, I think there's a compassion. You know, his desire would be that this person that he took a part in creating would see things and embrace him. Anything else? That's true too. Right. Yeah. Right. But I think you do see, like, when he weeps over Jerusalem, he has, you know, compassion on them. He wants, but it's not a saving compassion. There's a difference. I don't know. I think it's good to protect that difference. But anyway, yeah, we could have a whole series on that. Anything else? All right, let's sing. We're going to close with hymn 466. I sought the Lord, and afterward I knew He moved my soul to seek Him, seeking me. Reminder that God is the one who saves us, and that He works the desire to believe in us.